Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
Hey, and welcome to Perf Web 92. We've got a really exciting program for y'all today. Let me jump right in and get our housekeeping notes out of the way. I'm your host, Joe Basha. This is my co-host, Vicki Carlisle. I'm a perfusionist. She is a CVICU CCRN nurse and ECMO specialist, soon to be perfusion student. So that's going to happen soon as well, I hope. What do we need to do? Where am I looking? Three, five. Okay. Contact at perfusioneducation.com. Go there and you can leave us any emails you want or suggestions or comments, whatever it may be. Next, call in number. If you're listening and you want to call in, be live on the air and talk to our guest faculty today, 832-239-5358. That's 832-239-5358. Next. And on the bottom right there, you see our scroll bar that stays up all the time. You can find our phone number there, the whole nine yards. Okay, now let's jump right into our app. If you have not already done so, I need you to do this today. Even if you have done it, I need you to buy another one. It doesn't matter. We recently did an update, a really cool update on this, but the MediWeb critical care application for perfusionists, but also for ECMO specialists, for nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, doesn't make any difference. And let's go ahead and let me give a quick demonstration. Oh, podcast. Yes. You can go to whatever your podcast streaming platform you prefer and type in PerfWeb and you'll find our podcast. All of our programs will be on there. Okay, let's demonstrate this app real quick. So if you're a perfusionist, we'll just use that as an example. You go here, you've come to work in the morning, you hit perfusion quick calcs, you have a female patient. The patient is 68 years old. The pre-op hematocrit is 32, make her a little more complicated. You can have either inches or you can have centimeters. So we're gonna say she's 167 centimeters and she's a little on the chubby side. So we'll give her 82 kilos. Our pump prime is going to be 1,000, which is pretty reasonable. 700 I've seen as low as, and our conversation today about RAP is gonna be perfect for this conversation. Anesthesia volume, we'll say they probably gave her a liter. Anesthesia always floods our patients, we know that. Pre-pump urine is scant, and I'll put 100 cc's. You want your heparin dose calculated at 400 units per kilo. Hit calculate, and here's everything that spits out for you. BSA, BMI, estimated blood volume, red cell volume, heparin dose, estimated on pump hematocrit, 23.59. That's what it says, but I can tell you it's going to be lower than that. Protamine dose at the end of the case and all of your calculated flows from 1.6 to 3.0. So that's your morning routine, getting your perfusion quick calcs. But something we just added was DO2i. Now, when you do DO2, for example, you need to put in the arterial oxygen content. But what we did was decided to incorporate all of this. So if you're doing goal-directed perfusion, you can say my hemoglobin is 8. My saturation on pump is 100%. My PO2 is, My PO2 is 350. My cardiac output, which would be your pump flow, we'll say is 4 liters per minute. And the BSA of the patient was 1.85, calculate. And you can see your DO2i is 258.7. And you can look here and see what all of your normal values should be, 550 to 650. But there is a reasonable body of research to suggest that keeping your DO2i as high as you possibly can. But what's so neat is better, clearly, but anything under 250 would be very concerning. But let's just say you could actually keep that hemoglobin up to 9. let's look and see. You can quickly look and say, is it worth giving this patient a couple of units of PAC cells? I know that really concerns people to do, but look at the difference just off of that. You can increase the flow. You can't do anything with your saturation, but that's that. And then within this app is ECMO with a whole series of things. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Your PF ratio and all of these various different things. Hemodynamics, you want to calculate the SVR, you can do that very quickly right here. SVR, put in your parameters, it'll give you the number. And you also have a IV dose rate calculator, which is sold as a separate app. This is only $2.99. The IV calculator is only 99 cents. But let's do a medication, if you could maybe help me with this. Let's do Norepi. So I would do IV infusion rate. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. So dosage?
Let's try 20 mics.
20. Ooh, this patient's not doing well. Okay.
He needs a lot.
Weight, 100 kilos. Okay. Concentration amount?
Eight. Usually in 250.
Milligrams. Okay. And volume in 250. And calculate. And there it gives you your output. Your IV rate is going to be.
Nope, that's not right.
That's not right. Okay. So what did I do wrong here?
Because you have it for kilograms. It's not weight based.
Oh, it's not weight based. Oh, I'm sorry. So take that away.
Yeah.
My mistake. Okay. Let me go back. Infusion rate. Dosage we said was
uncheck
20.
The weight.
Uncheck the weight. That's there.
There you go.
I'm sorry. 20. Yeah, thank you. Amount was 8.
Mm-hmm.
Volume was 250. Mm-hmm. Calculate. There you go. 37 milliliters per hour.
And that is correct.
There you go. Perfect. So you have those two options. Now, I'm going to jump in. So before we actually introduce, go ahead and take that down. Before we introduce our faculty, I'm going to go ahead and give a couple of slides in advance and then bring in Emily Foreman, BSN and CCB perfusionist. So let's throw my slides up. If you remember last week, I gave this lecture and it had to do with RAP. I changed the name to Emily Foreman today, but in that conversation, I talked about, and I'll tell you how I got to this, actually, as we move on here, how I picked this as a topic. There's risks and benefits to everything that we do. The purported benefits of RAP, which I think we have to be we have to be intellectually inquisitive and honest with ourselves and look at everything objectively. Decreased hemodilution, which decreases transfusions, reduces AKI rates, theoretically improves oxygenation because you have decreased hemodilution. You saw that with the DO2i, right? Decreased vent times, theoretically, decreased length of stay, and of course, decreased cost. But the possible risks are hemodynamic instability while you're doing the RAP procedure, periods, although potentially very brief, of hypoperfusion. You do run a risk, albeit I think quite small, of air entrainment, but it's not zero. And of course, you have risks of any mishap that can happen. So if you remember from last week, I talked about this particular study. I also discussed this particular study. And where it all came down to was there's a lot of variables. Albumin levels, cardioplegia technique, pre-op condition of the patient, anesthesia technique, hemoconcentration or no hemoconcentration, and other inflammatory response mitigation, which led me to this particular study. And you can see the first author on this is Emily Foreman, who is our guest speaker today. And her talk was to RAP or not to RAP, which I thought was a great title, but it's a retrospective comparison of the effects of retrograde autologous priming versus not and other techniques. And I reached out to Emily and said, would you be willing to do this? And she was so gracious and very willing to do this. So I am excited to introduce you to Emily Foreman, BSN perfusionist. And Emily, I know very little about you other than our brief conversation on the telephone. So if you would perhaps just take a moment, introduce yourself, if you could. Tell us where you're from, where you work, where you're practicing, where you did your nursing, as much as you can about you so our audience knows who you are.
Great. Yes. Thank you guys for inviting me and for letting me come on your show today. My name is Emily Foreman. I am currently the Chief of Perfusion and ECMO Coordinator at Memorial Hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. I'm originally from Huntsville, Alabama, born and raised. Got my nursing degree from UAB and stuck around there for a few years before I went to perfusion school at Vanderbilt and graduated in 2016.
Oh, so you know Matt, Matt Warhoover.
I sure do.
Matt is such a great guy. Love Matt.
Yes, yes. And so after that, I moved to Chattanooga and I've been here ever since.
Excellent. So that's perfect. So how did you become interested in this as a topic? Because, you know, I always am so impressed with people who will take the time and actually publish material. I have a few little publications, mostly case reports, kind of reviews or how we do it kind of thing. But this kind of really critical analysis, I know takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and effort to compile all of this and make sense of it. How did you get this as a topic of interest for you?
It was actually assigned to me by one of our surgeons, more as a, he believed that wrap was causing negative post-op effects, and our perfusion team just buffed at him and said, there's no way. Let's make a bet on it, and we did, and you'll see towards the end of this presentation that the perfusion team lost, but we changed our practice, and just moving forward, are probably going to look some more into it.
That is outstanding. It's a great story. I just love this story. So with that said, we'll put your slides up, and Emily Foreman, the floor is yours.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I'm going to get my notes pulled back up here. But so this is the paper that I published towards the end of 2021 in JECT for AMSECT. And so it's, again, like you said, titled To Wrap or Not to Wrap. And we'll just jump right into it. So next. So the purpose was a quality improvement project to determine if wrap was actually beneficial with our patients. We have an incredibly low prime bypass circuit, which I will explain here in a few slides. And we have a very strict anesthesia preoperative protocol as well. So we analyzed about 40 different data points on each patient. So next. So let's see, reported benefits, which you kind of just talked on this a little bit, but reported benefits to wrap are limits hemodilution, limits your packed red blood cell transfusions, decreases third spacing, supposedly to increase cerebral and end organ perfusion, and an overall reduction in morbidity and mortality associated with cardiopulmonary bypass. Some possible negative post-op consequences could be the increase in post-operative albumin administration, and possibly an increase in post-operative AKI. So we stopped wrapping on all patients and retrospectively compared the two groups. And we examined all the things listed here, red blood cell transfusion, indexed oxygen delivery, post-operative acute kidney injury, albumin administration, both intraoperatively and post-operatively. We looked at ventilator times, ICU length of stay, and 30-day mortality. So next. So before we started this, we theorized that wrap was negatively impacting our incidence of acute kidney injury. And it was, the potential for red blood cell rates to increase in the no wrap group. We thought that would happen. We thought our indexed oxygen delivery would actually decrease in the no wrap group because of the hemodilution. And we thought that the wrap patients were requiring more fluid resuscitation, whether that was with albumin or crystalloid, however we could get volume in. So next. So we looked at over 1,300 patients in a consecutive time period. So we included everybody, because as perfusionists, let's be honest, you don't just wrap the isolated CABG patients. We wrap everybody, right? So we looked at elective urgents, emergents. We looked at reduced sternotomies, Sirkaris patients. And so the breakdown in cases, most of our patients were isolated CABGs. The next bit largest group was CABG AVR, followed by CABG mazes. The rest were a combination of every valve you can name, repairs or replacements, dissections, aneurysms, combined cases, things like that. So out of that, we wrapped 519 patients, and we decided not to wrap 784 patients. The only thing that changed between these two groups was whether we wrapped or not. All other perfusion practices remained the same. So next. So we wanted to compare the two patient groups preoperatively. So we looked at patient age, BSA, their preoperative hemoglobin, which is taken prior to their entry in the OR, preoperative creatinine, and whether or not they had a history of chronic kidney disease or end-stage renal disease. So this table basically shows that there was no statistically significant difference between the two groups. After that, we added all of our data into a spreadsheet. I sent it off to a statistician, which if you ever plan on publishing, find a statistician, because that made life so much better than me trying to do this all by myself. Throughout the whole paper, though, the corrected significant p-value is going to be less than 0.002. It's a tight p-value, but that's because we had so many patients and so many variables that we looked at. So next slide. Preoperatively, I mentioned a little bit that we have a very strict anesthesia protocol in pre-op. So we restrict the amount of fluid these patients get. They usually get less than 250 cc's. Usually their IVs are just set to KVO, where we can just keep their lines open and things like that. So next. We do a little bit of prescriptive perfusion, even though we're an adult-only center. So we have two different sides oxygenators. We use the Terumo FX15 and the Terumo FX25. We will upsize to that larger 25 if the patient's indexed flow is greater at 2.2 liters per minute is greater than 5. So we'll go up to the big circuit. On both circuits, we have a standard AV loop of 3/8 to 1/2 inch. We do use the Quest MPS system for cardioplegia. And we prime with either Normosol or Plasmolite, whichever one happens to be in stock. Supply chain is a mess. And the total prime volume after we cut away some lines at the field for our small circuit is 800 cc's. For our large circuit is 900 cc's. We are a very simple perfusion group. We don't have a lot of fuss to our circuit, and we plan on keeping it that way.
Very good. So,
yes. Next. Priming drugs, we do mannitol 12.5 grams, 12.5 grams of albumin, and 50 milliequivalents of bicarb. In the no wrap group, we remove all the crystalloid, take our level all the way down, and then add our priming drugs. We just remove our crystalloid and then we add our priming drugs. In the wrap group, we would wrap first and then add our priming drugs. Mm-hmm. But in both groups, the prime volume is considered the same. So, next. Just a standard wrap. After we would arterially cannulate, we would go ahead and start our wrap. As long as we maintained a mean pressure greater than 55, and depending on the patient would depend on how fast we could do this. Also, we had to maintain a systolic greater than 90. And we, like I said, we did this on most of our patients, where we would wrap the arterial line and the oxygenator, and then we would also VAP as we would initiate. So mm-hmm. Our average wrap volume when we did it was between 500 to 600 mLs per patient.
And VAP is being just the venous line wrapping as well.
Correct.
So you just basically put the crystalloid into the bag and then clamp the bag open the line and go on. And I'm just saying that for Vicky's benefit, so she has a better understanding of that. Did you use, and I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but did you use pressors to keep that pressure above 90, or did you only rely on the patients? So what maneuvers were made there?
We relied heavily on the patient themselves, and we would stop if they got either a MAP less than 55 or 60 or a systolic less than 90. So we tried not to use pressors.
Very good.
Okay, next slide. So while on pump, we have pretty standard protocols with that. We do run a non-pulsatile centrifugal head. So our goal index is somewhere between 2.2 to 2.4 liters per minute. And that is based off of a BSA that uses the patient's actual height and weight, which will come into importance later. SVO2 greater than 70%, mean arterial pressure somewhere between 55 to 70, acceptable cerebral oximetry, so at least more than 20% below their baseline, and at least greater than 40%. And we would try to increase MAP, we would try to increase flow. If we had to give a unit of blood, we would. And cooling, we would only cool to about 34, 35 degrees Celsius, unless it was a circ arrest, since, again, we included all of our patients in this study. So our transfusion triggers for red blood cells were a hemoglobin less than 8 or an SVO2 less than 65, despite increasing flows. We also took our hemoconcentrators out of our circuit at the end of the wrap period. And the only patients that did get a hemoconcentrator was if we used custodial cardioplegia on those isolated valves or aneurysms and dissections. And at that point, we only removed the custodial that was given. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, the crystallate administered to the patient was similar in both groups. And next slide. So we also looked at to make sure that there was no difference between the two groups between the actual bypass numbers. So our pump, we looked at pump times, cross clamp times, indexed flows. We compared who got custodial between the two groups, who got microplegia between the two groups. We looked at first hemoglobin on bypass, which was taken within the first 20 minutes of initiation, and then the average hemoglobin on bypass. So we look at all of this, and between the two groups, where our original theory was that our DO2 and our indexed flow would be lower in the NORAP group, I'll go into this in some more detail later, but it was actually higher in that group, statistically significantly higher in the NORAP group. We were able to flow more. So we theorized that it was because we just had more volume to work with, that we could flow better with them. So next. So intraoperatively, just continuing on all the data points that we pulled, fluid administration was the total amount of crystalloid that anesthesia gave from OR admission to ICU admission. So that does not include anything that perfusion gave, because we tried not to give any extra crystalloid on pump. Intraoperative hemoglobin was recorded as the first set of labs after patient intubation. The first hemoglobin on bypass was drawn within 20 minutes of initiation. The hemodilution will be the change from that first intraoperative level to the average on pump. Index oxygen delivery was the average cardiac index and the average hemoglobin on bypass. That's the two values we used for that. Intraoperative albumin volume includes the amount that anesthesia gave in addition to what the perfusionist gave while on bypass. So to go back to our theories, we thought that the NORAP group would be hemodiluted due to the excess crystalloid requiring an increase in red blood cells. The average first hemoglobin on bypass and the average overall hemoglobin in the RAP group was 10, while it was 9.9 in the NORAP group, which is not statistically significant. So the only two significant values on this whole chart were that hemodilution of hemoglobin was higher in the NORAP group, which is to be expected, but it doesn't translate to the amount of packed red blood cells that those patients got. So while we did hemodilute them a little bit more, it was not enough to warrant red blood cell transfusions. Fluids, index oxygen delivery, albumin administration, all of that were not statistically significant. However, it is worth mentioning that the indexed oxygen delivery was higher in the NORAP group, which would have been significant by standard p-value measurements, and is also expected since the average index flows were higher in the NORAP group. So, next slide. Postoperatively, we also continued this and looked at the ICU, because much of what perfusion does in the operating room does still affect that patient postoperatively. So, postoperative, our protocols include giving albumin, the big 250 bottles of albumin, if for hypovolemia, if we looked at a TEE, pulmonary artery diastolic less than 12, CVP less than 10, or a systolic less than 90. They have the same intraoperative transfusion protocols for red blood cells, hemoglobin less than 8, and in terms of ventilator weaning, our ICU nurses and respiratory therapists would communicate to our anesthesiologists to continue vent weaning. So next. So the post-op metrics that we looked at here, we used the rifle criteria for acute kidney injury. And it was considered a complication if the patient's creatinine was more than double the baseline value drawn preoperatively. So we measured creatinine on ICU admission and later that night, day of surgery, and then on post-op days 1 and 2 are the values that we looked at. And so any patient who experienced acute kidney injury at any time in the post-op period was included in this table. Ventilator time is the number of minutes from intubation in the operating room to extubation in the ICU. So our postoperative results for this whole table, that everything was statistically insignificant except for the amount of albumin those patients got. Our RAP patients got more albumin in the post-op period than the NORAP group. So next. So discussion, now that I've given you all of the information about the bypass runs and the patients and the post-op stuff. So this whole study was done to determine if RAP was beneficial in our patient population. So prior to 2017, we RAPed almost everybody as much as we could, because we supported the theories that RAP would be advantageous in protecting our patients. However, when we look at all of our original theories, only one of our original theories was proven to be significant, which was the increased amount of albumin administered postoperatively. Since we showed no statistically significant difference between our RAP patients and our no RAP patients, we determined that RAP was just not beneficial for our people. So it actually sacrificed oxygen delivery. But since the averaged index delivery is still greater than the recommended 260 to 270, this could possibly explain why there was no change to our acute kidney injury. So additionally, our results show there may be an increase in postoperative fluid resuscitation in these RAP patients. And so while we considered our analysis included all patients and all surgical types over a 2-year period, we just observed the benefits of RAP without having to do the actual procedure, all because we limited our pre-op fluid administration and because we minimized our circuit as much as possible. Next slide. So of course, where there's limitation, where there's pros, there's cons, and there's limitations, right? The average oxygen delivery was analyzed for each patient. We didn't actually look at what the lowest oxygen delivery on pump was. We only looked at averages. The inclusion of redo cases, circulatory arrest, emergent and salvage cases may have erroneously extended some of our postoperative values, our ventilator times, IC length of stay, and 30-day mortality. So we would like to further look at this by eliminating those cases and looking at just isolated elective and urgent CABGs. Also, the large sample size and the amount of comparisons that we made interpretation of statistical significance kind of quite difficult, if we're being honest. And we were limited to evaluating postoperative fluid resuscitation to albumin because there were some inconsistencies in the way the nurses charted their IV fluid administration. So next. So furthermore, again, I talked about we want to look at just isolated cabbages. And to continue, is wrap, there more research needs to be done, is wrap beneficial in condensed circuits? And next. So my last little slide here is that after all was said and done, there was no statistically significant impact of wrap on red blood cell transfusion, postoperative AKI, intraoperative albumin administration, ventilator times, ICU length of stay, or 30-day mortality. The biggest statistically significant thing that we saw, there was a higher postoperative albumin administration in the wrap group, and that was it. So when all was said and done, we just determined that wrap was not beneficial in our patient group with our pre-op fluid administration protocols and our low prime bypass circuit. Next, I think that's all for me. Yeah, that's it.
Well, wait a minute, Emily. What did your doc win? What did your surgeon win? You bet.
Bragging rights.
Just bragging rights, nothing. I mean, it could have been, a good bottle of scotch, dinner at a nice restaurant, pretty much anything. I mean, you could have picked something.
No, he's prideful, and so he likes to say, "I told you so."
Yes.
So we have heard that a lot.
Well, he's not going to tell me he told you so, because I have agreed with him for a very long time. But we have one surgeon here who is absolutely convinced that this is the second coming of saving patients. It's what will save this patient, and that is just, I just do not think that would bear out even if we were to do the same thing. And I do compliment you. You know, I thought 1,000 cc's liter circuit be a pretty condensed circuit. You're down 800 900. I think that's great. I think we could all do better in that regard. I want to bring Vicky in, but I want to ask the online questions first. We've got several, and I'm just going to start from the top and go from there. Were your flows index lower in the wrap group on bypass? I think you did address that. Yes. So it was, yes.
But only by maybe like 8/10 of an index. Mm-hmm. Back to that slide. It wasn't by much, but yes, they were lower.
Very little, yes. And then you've already explained, I think, incidence of AKI in the wrap group versus the there was no difference, basically, as I recall. Does your institution utilize hemoconcentrators routinely for your cases? Do you have it ready and available, or just do not hemoconcentrate?
We generally do not hemoconcentrate unless we use custodial cardioplegia, with the exception being the patients where maybe those isolated mitral valves that are just incredibly volume overloaded.
Yes.
It's a conversation that we have to have with the surgeons, where we almost have to get approval before we will put a hemoconcentrator in, but they're not routinely in our circuits. They're in our rooms where we can add them at any time, but on most day-to-day cases, we do not hemoconcentrate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was very struck by your anesthesia protocol of less than 250 cc's, because that is not my experience. It sounds to me like what I'm hearing is you guys work together very cohesively towards, almost like you actually have a heart care team approach versus everybody, all the Sesame Street kids, we're all doing our own thing, which I think you see a lot of. Another question, out of the 519 patients, and how many patients did you have to give back what you wrapped due to lack of volume? That's a very good question.
That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer to that. Okay. We did not have that in our tally, and you know, nobody's ever asked me that question. So I wish I had looked at that, and going back, it was something that we thought about, but we were at the end of the study and had to get it done. So
very good. He also asks, what's your minimum CVP? And I'm assuming he means preoperatively, whether you will or won't rep. In other words, was this randomized, or was this, do you actually look and say this patient's CVP is 6, we can't wrap this patient, or the CVP is 12, easier patient to do that with?
We didn't. We wrapped the CVP of 6 as well.
Okay.
And so, the thing that it was just one date we picked, and my surgeon walked in and said, "We're not wrapping anymore, and you're going to look at the before and after." So
very
there
good.
Was no random date to it. It was a hard stop.
Very good. I think that's really impressive. I want to bring Vicki Carlisle in here because Vicki has an extensive experience in the CVICU and deals with a lot of this. And what I hear from surgeons, one in particular, more so than others, is that when the patient, when I do ultrafiltrate, because I'm pretty aggressive with ultrafiltration, we use Delnido cardioplegia. So, you know, I'm giving a liter of crystalloid that I didn't want to give. Our anesthesia gives massive amounts of volume. In fact, they treat hypotension, normotension, and hypertension all the same way. And that's just to give more volume. We, you know, are not doing a great job measuring COPs or albumin levels. I've seen patients that had albumin levels of 2.1, 2.2. I've corrected the albumin, and then I go from a liter in my tank to 4 liters in my tank, and I'm pulling all of this excess volume off. But what's your experience in terms of coming to, because you guys know which you can, I've heard you guys talk about which perfusionist was doing the case before based on the amount of volume you've had to resuscitate the patient with. Like, what do you guys experience in the ICU with that?
Well, we don't really know which patients were wrapped and which ones weren't, but we kind of go by what they look like coming out of the operating room, if they're really dry. And sometimes our anesthesiologist will tell us that ahead of time, you know, this guy's going to be really dry. And we kind of go from there. So like you, hemo concentrate a lot. So we kind of know they're coming to us on a more euvolemic to a drier side. And usually that works out just fine. Some patients come back and they warm up and dilate out, and we're just having to give them tons of volume. So I wish we did actually know which patients had wrap and which ones didn't, because that'd be good information.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Emily, and you'll have to forgive me, you know, oh, by the way, you've gotten several compliments. Thank you. Nice presentation. And I would offer that to you as well. I think you did
very
an outstanding
good.
Job with this entire thing. My compliments to you and your team. I'm somewhat, I think, harsh, maybe the way I say things, that I feel like wrap has become gimmicky, and it's this laborious, complex looking procedure that we do to, you know, make ourselves look really important. And I feel like our circuits, even at 800 and 900, are bigger than they need to be. For example, our group, you know, we practice very independently. We go to multiple hospitals. And I, you know, I'm not a micromanaging kind of person. I figure people are going to practice their trade. They're paid professionals, and that's what, you know, they're doing. But from my perspective, we use vacuum assist venous drainage. I'm assuming you do too. But we're using, you know, so we're using half inch venous lines, and instead of a 3/8 inch venous line, which would save on volume. I like to run my reservoir higher because it's a shorter distance from the table versus lower. So I do a lot of those kinds of things to try and really minimize. But we have surgeons that have, you know, the surgeon loop on the venous line, where, you know, it's like they've looped it 3 times. It's like not necessary. Cut the line shorter. I just think there's so many things we can do where if you're talking about a circuit, let's say that was 700 cc's of volume, that's like giving somebody a half a liter of saline for some reason. And if that is the result of needing transfusion, that patient has bigger problems in my perspective. I also am very impressed with your transfusion trigger, because that's not something you see very frequently now. They're really looking at much less, like down around 7, and even at 6.5, you have a lot of resistance to giving transfusions. How are you guys overcoming that? And you're a pretty large volume account, so I can't imagine that you're cherry picking cases. You're getting some, you have to be getting your share of sick patients. So how, I mean, that's pretty aggressive in my view. I like it, but how are you reconciling that with all of the brouhaha associated with transfusions?
So when our patients just roll in the operating room, they're so dry. They're drier than a potato chip. I mean, they don't have any volume for us to really wrap off. So we didn't really have an option to where we just couldn't wrap them anymore. And so since they haven't gotten a lot of volume preoperatively, they just don't need transfusions. You saw our transfusion rate was, 10.3% compared to 10.4% between the two?
No difference.
That was laughably insignificant, but we still just aren't having to transfuse these patients, even with our no wrap. It's just such a small circuit, we don't have to.
Now, real interesting.
Unless they really get sick.
No, I think that's such a good point. You know, and I'm on your side. Jim, okay, is pointing out to me he believes that wrap is better than hemoconcentration to start because, one, you have less crystalloid third spacing from the start and your nadir CPB crit is higher, which, you know, I kind of see his point, but there's this risk to benefit. So is, you know, I come from way back in the day, I'll go way back to the time machine, we used to mix. So we would heparinize, cannulate, do all that stuff, and then I would drain some out of the venous line and then slowly give some in arterial and then do that over and over and over again because our circuit was like 2,500 cc's. And you know, back in the old, I'm talking about in the late 70s, early 80s. And so we would do that so that we didn't have this rush of just crystalloid, because you go on bypass, you have this like seemingly forever before the arterial blood's in there. And we didn't think that would be good for people. But you couldn't wrap a circuit that big. I mean, you just couldn't do it. Patient would be, you know, on a given 20 mics of norepi, right? You know, so we can't do that. Jeff Campbell, not Jim, I'm sorry. I meant Jeff Jim, so forgive me. And he's at the University Hospitals at Cleveland. Okay, so he moved. Wrap is also beneficial in the face of using Delnito or custodial due to their amount of crystalloid addition to the circuit. And Jim, I love you, but I just disagree. I think if you're going to use Delnito or custodial, you go on bypass and you start hemoconcentrating and you hemoconcentrate off whatever additional volume you gave the patient, but you need to start early. And I'm very aggressive with ultrafiltration. I feel like you need to correct your COP. You need to make sure your albumin is your highest contributor to that. Make sure your albumin levels are normal. And it's always easier to give volume than it is to get volume out of a patient, in my opinion. And I feel like the data is very strong supporting drier patients do better than a patient who is edematous, because they're not just edematous in their eyelids, they're edematous in all of their organs. Emily, your thoughts on that?
I think it depends on your circuit and how big your circuit is. So if you do have one of those larger 1500 prime volume, 2 liter prime volume, then you probably do need to wrap. You need to wrap a little bit because like you said, you initiate and you're giving that patient 1500 to 2 liters of crystalloid within 10, 15 seconds. So the key thing that we did have to change when we started not wrapping is we do initiate slower. So we give enough time for mixing and all of that. Even though we've limited our prime volume, we still have to go on slow. So it's not 800 to 900 cc's of crystalloid going straight to the brain. and causing all those problems. And in addition to the comment about the hematocrit and it being higher, if you look at our at all of our data, our hematocrit was, the difference was 10.1 to 9.9, which is still not a huge difference.
No,
and it goes back to what you said, 8 to 900 in an adult is not a huge amount of volume. So it goes back to the most important thing about this paper was limiting prime volume and limiting the preoperative volume that's given to these patients.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Amit also said, I think it's all about patient selection. I agree with you there. For example, if you have a small patient with a crit of 29 and high CVP and a good blood pressure, then I would certainly wrap. I still wouldn't. I would go and bypass an ultrafiltrate, but that's okay. I can understand his rationale. But of course, if patient is dry, has a high crit, then he wouldn't. And I think that is very true. I think you do have to treat patients as individuals. That's one of the reasons why I've never been very supportive of protocolized perfusion practice, because patients are all different.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I mean, fluid overload is a big problem in the ICU. Like you said, it's easier to get the fluid euvolemic rather than take it off later, which does make a difference to the patient's outcome on our end, on how fast we can extubate and how dilated they get and pressor support. And so, I mean, I agree.
Yeah. I think that we can hide so much volume in a patient. It's just amazing at how much the tissue will actually hold. And at the microcirculatory level, increased volume in that just in that flow distribution area, I think can be very easily compromised. I do really believe that. Uh-oh, somebody's calling in. It's somebody probably mad at me because I'm, you too now, because you're an anti-rapper. You're gonna get, you know what? We're both gonna be in trouble. Hello, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hey, Joe, it's Jeff Campbell.
Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Yeah, nothing. I was trying to watch most of the presentation, but I'm covering assaults here at Outlying Hospital, so I'm kind of was in the OR. My question was, so I didn't get to see the entire presentation. I did see some of the paper on a previous, I think you had presented that paper in another perf web, but
I did.
Emily wasn't there to.
But
yeah,
Emily,
yeah,
did
read
a
that.
Emily did a much better job presenting it than I did, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
So I guess my question was, I didn't see what her prime, what the circuit change they made, like are they running 3/8 inch venous line with vacuum? How did they miniaturize their circuit down to 900 a liter?
So our circuit's always been the same, even when we were wrapping. So we do have a 3/8 arterial line, 1/2 inch venous. We go on with a wet venous line. We don't actually use vacuum routinely. We just have very large venous cannulas. And we push up to the table as close as we can get without contaminating the table when we hand up lines. And our little lines holder sits above the patient's hip, so they're close to the chest as well. And we're able to cut off a good portion of our lines after we hand them up. And then since we use microplegia, our prime volume for that's very small as well. And our circuits, we have one recirc line and our manifold and our AV loop, and that's it. That's all that comes off the oxygenator, with the exception of the centrifugal head, but just small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, I think that that makes sense. And if you could get it even smaller, of course, I am curious, why do you not use VAVD?
Because our surgeons don't like it. They think we pull air more, and our routinely our venous cannula is a 3646 from Edwards dual state. So we just have a super large cannula and we don't need it. Our femoral venous cannulas, a lot of times we don't even need vacuum with our femoral venous because we use up to a 29 French with that.
Wow. And good placement. if you get it up real high in the up to the SVC, the tip in the SVC, and all those holds in the atrium, you're right, you don't need it. But if, for those who don't necessarily take the time, it sounds like you have some really good surgeons who are very methodical, you know, and careful. And I'm really impressed at your team. I truly am at your team approach. And I think that's another topic that we can discuss moving forward. Just so you know, Karma is in agreement with us. And that with ultrafiltration, much safer once on bypass, no risk of major hemodynamic instability, low cost, and you can control the patient volume in the post-bypass period. That's absolutely true, because I'll come off bypass and I will hemoconcentrate what is left in my reservoir if I have too much and get it down, and then I'll use Chase to get everything back into the patient. My goal is to only have one unit of Cell Saver blood given back to the patient. Did you say we had another phone call? Oh, Jeff, you're still there. Shoot, Jeff, I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm just listening or whatever.
I forgot he was there.
We wrapped on all of our patients at my previous job. I've been here for 2 months, but, I mean, it's set up. We go on with dry venous line, happens tubing, and wrap everyone. My last job, everyone got Del Nido. Every case is Del Nido. And if I got a good, sometimes I didn't even have to hemoconcentrate. Other cases I did. Mm-hmm. But here we use microplegia most of the time. We do use Del Nido on valves. But at both places I wrapped, when they told me to go on bypass, that's when I wrapped. So if the patient got, we had instability or hypotension, the wrap was then aborted. And then we just rolled on pump. So just retrograde, prime the arterial line back, and then open the venous while the arterial was still clamping, just chased all the crystal out with blood and then rolled on, whatever. But I don't know. I think it is. I mean, the primes at both those centers was probably like, I don't know what our prime here is, probably 12 maybe, or 12 to 1500, you know, ml circuits. After wrap, you could get it down to 500, but I think it is institution specific as your circuit prime and surgeons and stuff like that, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a pretty good sized circuit. I mean, that's a big circuit in my view. But, you know, again,
yeah,
every place is different.
Wet is probably 12, I think. I don't know. Mm-hmm. 'Cause we just drop 2 liters and we just pump it all out. So I'm not really sure what it is wet here.
I understand.
12.
I understand. Well, why did you move
but
to Cleveland?
This line, that saves you a lot.
That does. I mean, I've go on with the dry venous line too, but you can't do that if you don't have, I mean, you can, but it's much more challenging to do if you're not using vacuum assist.
Oh yeah. You have to use vacuum assist, whatever.
Yeah. You could
usually
do
it off after I get on pump. If I can get the full flow without it, I turn it off, whatever.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I just think that Emily is onto something here and her group, that the machinations that we go through to wrap these lines and do all that stuff, I think, and again, you know, everything has a potential benefit and everything has a potential risk. I think her data in her program, I think demonstrates what her conclusions are, and Emily, just chime in and correct me if I'm wrong, is that in their patient population with their circuit, there was no benefit to wrapping, and that, you know, there wasn't necessarily a detriment either. So I think your surgeon really didn't win the bet. I think he lost the bet, if you really want to know my opinion, because he didn't show that wrapping was causing AKI. What I think you proved in your particular program, with your particular circuit and paradigm, is that there was no benefit to it, but still an increase in potential risk, because every maneuver we do will carry an inherent risk, albeit small. It's not zero. So I saw no benefit.
Was the indexes? I didn't see that. I'd ask that question. A lot of times with the wrap, you just don't have a lot of circuit volume, so you can't run as high indexes as you'd like, whatever. So was it AKI because the indexes, flows and indexes in the wrap group weren't as high as the non-wrap? Because you have less volume, operating volume for the circuit, right? less so on smaller patients. So you may not be able to get to as high a flow as you would like, even though all other parameters, perfusion parameters may be, fine, SpO2, head sats, stuff like that. You may be running a 2 index instead of a 2.4 or 2.6 or something, I was just curious why they had increased incidence of AKI, if they were tracking their DO2 indexes and what those were,
Still unknown.
Maybe she has it in the data, what the DO2 indexes were and all that on the cases.
Yeah, we still don't exactly know why our acute kidney injury has just been elevated. It won RAP. We thought it might have been, the hemodilution, but that we were hemodynamically compromising patients, and maybe we were making them too dry, and that's why they came out with AKI. But our AKI was the same in both groups.
Yeah, because they are drier.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But they were the same in both groups, so it was not because of RAP.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know.
Very
still
good. Yeah, exactly.
AKI,
there's all kinds of mysteries. Well, listen, in deference to time, this has been a very loud. Jeff, thank you so much for calling in. You have no idea how much I appreciate
it's just that. It's just easier to call for me to listen when I'm sitting in the OR watching the Cell Saver. So.
You have a bleeding patient?
No, they sent me to an outlying hospital just to do a Cell Saver on a lumbar laminectomy.
Oh, okay.
I figured I want to pump a case.
I figured you were doing.
I'm at a satellite hospital.
Exactly. I figured you were doing a Cell Saver on a coagulopathic bleeding patient that was caused by RAP.
No, we don't really. We never have those.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yesterday we did have a bleeding patient. It was a multiple gunshots to the chest and abdomen. He bled.
Oh my God!
Put him on pump.
Do this kind of craziness. Emily, you can come too. In fact, you're first. we're really cool down here. It's really a lot of fun. You know what?
All right, we'll catch up.
See ya, Jeff. Hey, do me one favor. I'm gonna close this out with my slide from last month. Throw my slides up. Okay. We're going to leave the wrapping to the wrappers. All right. Bring Emily back up.
All right.
Thank you. Jeff, take care of yourself. Emily, you take care of yourself. We're ending right on time. And this has been very invigorating and very exciting. And we cannot thank you enough for sharing this wonderful research and experience with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. And we'll see all of you. Our next Perf Web 93, which is scheduled for sometime in the near future. Check out our website, perfweb.us, to get the exact date. We'll see you then. Bye, everyone.